Om Parataya Pratipotitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Puranamunina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamritavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanusantadami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadveshini. Okay. Continuing on with verse 28. Ayudhanam aham vajram. Ayudhanam aham vajram. Denunam asmi kamaduk, denunam asmi kamaduk, prajanas chasmi kandarpaha, prajanas chasmi kandarpaha, sarapanam asmi vasukihi, sarapanam asmi vasukihi, ayudhanam aham vajram, denunam asmi kamaduk, prajanahacha asmi kandarpaha sarpanam asmi vasukihi. He says ayudhanam, of the ayudhas are the weapons. I think the ayudhas were weapons that are actually held in the hand, but the ayudhas are weapons. And he says of the weapons I am the vajra. And there's a story, I don't know really the details of the story, but I actually remember reading the story recently in Bhandarka when we're doing our Sanskrit sentences, and Swamiji also mentioned it. Dadichi was a sage, and I think Indra and some of the devas were unable to kill an asura, one of the asuras or rakshasas that was causing a lot of problems for all of the rishis and all the people in the world. And so there was no way to kill this asura or raksha, I don't remember. And so he was advised to go to this sage Dadichi and to get his bones and to make a vajra, this type of a weapon from the bones of this sage. So the sage gave up his life to give the bones to Indra to make this vajra. So he says, among all of the ayudhas, I am the vajra made of the bones of Dadichi, who just happily gave over his bones. So, and then he says, denunam asmi kamaduk, of the cows, I am the kamaduk. You know, cows and milk are very sacred in India, so milk is a staple. So all of the cows, you know, freely give of their milk to all of the people. But the kamaduk is a cow that not only gives milk, it gives whatever is desired. And so there's a long story about this also that briefly goes like this. There was a sage out in the rishi out in the forest, who, just a small ashram, and Vishwamitra, who was a king, came with his retinue to passing through, and they stopped at the ashram of Vasishtha. And Vishwamitra his whole retinue needed food, and so Vasishtha, just from his little ashram, provided them with everything they needed. And as Vishwamitra became aware of this, he discovered, I think from talking to Vasishtha, about the kamaduk, this cow, this sacred cow, that would just fulfill whatever desires were there for that, whatever Vasishtha wanted. So Vasishtha could just say, could you please, you know, give whatever's necessary to take care of this very large retinue. Well, when Vishwamitra heard about the kamaduk, he wanted it for himself. But Vasishtha said, you know, to really um, to have the Kamaduk give to you, you have to be a Brahmana. You know, Brahmana means, and Brahmana just a Brahmana in terms of the caste system, but also you have to have a very sattvic mind and all this. And so Vishwamitra just said, oh, fine, I'll become a Brahmana. So he did whatever was necessary to become the Brahmana. But he hadn't controlled his anger and his temper. He had a bad temper. And so the Kamaduk, you know, wouldn't give anything, you know, because he'd become a Brahmana, but he hadn't controlled his anger. And so Vishwamitra actually spent years and years and years subduing his anger and getting the antikarna and shuddhi necessary for the Kamaduk to be able to provide for him. But by that time, he no longer needed it. So that's a really nice story. So he says, but Krishna says, Denu nam asmi kamaduk. Among all of the cows, I am the kamaduk. And then he says, prajanaha cha asmi kandarpaha. Kandarpa is Cupid. And so he says, I am the Cupid. You know, and then prajanaha, this isn't no longer among a group. It's I am the prajanaha. I am the one who procreates. I am the one who produces, who procreates. I'm the procreator. And I am the Cupid. So what Swamiji says is, you know, he goes like this. Among the parents of children, of the children, you know, I am Cupid. I am the one who makes that, who makes that, you know, those progeny happen. Prajana means the one who begets, or it also means the sexual organs, but it also means the one who brings forth or who impregnates is the prajana. So I'm the impregnator, you know, and I'm the one who is Cupid, who brings about that that magic, the magic of attraction that allows for those progeny to be produced. And then he says, from there he goes to Sarpanam. He says, Asmi Vasukihi. Of the sarpas, among all of the snakes, I am Vasuki. Now, Swamiji talks about, there's two, and we'll see later also, there's two types of snakes. The sarpas are the snakes that are single-headed, as opposed to the nagas, which have many heads. The sarpas have only one head, and also they have venom. They're also poisonous. So he says, among this type of snake, I am Vasuki. But Vasuki is, there's a story of the churning of the ocean, where the asuras and the devas had to come together to churn this ocean, and they took Mount Meru and turned it upside down, and then used Vasuki, this huge, long, long snake, as the rope to churn the ocean, to churn Mount Meru, to churn this ocean of milk, which produced this amrita, this nectar, along with many, many other things it produced. One we saw yesterday, the horse that was given to Indra, and also the famous elephant that was given to Indra. So many, many things were produced from the churning of this ocean. But Vasuki, this great serpent, was the snake. So he says, among all of the snakes, of all of the sarpas, all of the venomous single headed snakes, I am Vasuki. So let's continue. Anantas chasmina ganam, varuno yadasamaham, pitrinam aryama chasmi, yamasam yamatamaham, anantaha cha asmi naganam, Varunaha yadasam aham, pitrinam aryama cha asmi, yamaha samyamatam aham. He says, of the Nagas are non-poisonous, many-headed snakes. So of this group of snakes, the Nagas, he says, I am Ananta. Ananta is Adi, I think, Adishesha. Adishesha was a great snake, a naga, great devotee of Vishnu, of Lord Vishnu. And when you see pictures of Lord Vishnu, you know, Vishnu where Brahmaji is the creator, Vishnu is the sustainer. And so when you see a picture of Vishnu, he will be lying down on Adishesha, also called Ananta. And so you see Vishnu lying down in this relaxed pose, you know, on top of the coiled Adishesha, the snake called, another name is Ananta. Now, Ananta means that which is endless or limitless. Anta means an end, you know. Ananta means without an end. And the snakes are always often, in India, represent the Shakti, you know, the Maya Shakti. And so here, Ananta is the endless or the limitless Maya Shakti upon which Vishnu is relaxing. Because Vishnu, and you can also think, like with Vishnu, the whole creation is his, you know, sankalpa or Vishnu's dream in a sense. And so Vishnu is lying recoiled on this Maya Shakti, which is Adidesha, his great devotee, right? And maintaining the whole creation. So he says, among the Nagas, I am Ananta. I am that infinite Maya Shakti, the Sarpa, the Naga, who has an Adidesha has 1,000 heads. So limitless Shakti, limitless power, you know, and all held in a very relaxed way by Vishnu. Right? Vishnu is just simply relaxing on all of that Shakti. And then it says, Varunaha Yadasamaham. It says, Varuna is the deity, the devata of all the waters. And so, the lord of the water. So, Yadas can be it can be water creatures, but it can also be the devata, the different devatas of water. All of the different devatas that have to do, like all the different devatas that have to do with the rivers, for instance. So among all of the devatas of the waters, or among all of the creatures of the waters, I am Varuna, the one who is the lord of all of the water. So Swamiji did different things with this, but and eventually ended up with Shankara, who says, Aham of devatanam, means of all of the devatas, the water, ab means water, up from up. Of all of the water devatas, I am Varuna, because Varuna is the king. He says, when he says, I am Varuna, he says, Shankara says, I am King Varuna. Varuna is considered the king. Like Indra is considered the devata, the king of all of the devatas. Varuna is the king of all of the devatas that have to do with water, have anything to do with water. So he says, among all of the water devatas, I am Varuna. Then he says, Pitrinam Aryama cha asmi. I am Aryama of all of the Pitras. Now what the Pitras are, there are different levels, lokas, what we call different lokas for the jiva, that the jiva goes to between human births. And the Pitras, you may have heard, sometimes they're called the manes in English, the M-A-N-E-S, the manes. What the manes are what those people, good people, dharmic people, but people who haven't done all of the Vedic rituals, but they follow Dharma, they're Dharmanishtas, you know, where those people go in between births is called the Pitras, the manes, or the world of the fathers. And Aryama is like Indra, he is the king of that world. So he says, of the Pitras, I am Aryama, okay? So, Pitranam Aryama cha asmi. So Aryama is the name of that devata who is the lord of the Pitras, or the head of the Pitras. So the Pitras are where the Dharmanishtas, dharmic good people go who are not performing all of the Vedic rituals that are enjoined on them, you know, within the Vedic culture, but still they're Dharmanishtas, so this is their world where they will be between lives on this loka. Then he says, Yamaha samyamatam aham. I am Lama, Yama, I'm Lord Yama. Yama is the Lord of Death, the one who's responsible for taking away, you know, for taking away your life. So of all of the disciplinarians, you know, of all of the people, not just disciplinarians in a negative way, it says, Samyamatam, of all of those beings and people who control things, who are controllers, you know, who keep things in order, you know, and have that responsibility to control and to manage and to maintain and to discipline, among all of them, I am the Lord of Death. You know, and it's interesting. I mean, everybody has to die, and that death is kind of the sacred, feared moment for all beings. All beings have to face their own death, but it can be a feared moment. You don't run toward Yama, you know. we don't make a beeline toward Yama. We'll make a beeline, you know, toward Ganesha, you know, or to one of the deities that will help us to go on, you know. Swamiji always sometimes jokes about Yama in terms of this knowledge, because when you gain this knowledge, it's kind of understood we're not unfolding this right now, but when you do gain this knowledge, there is no coming back for you as a jiva. Once that jnanam is there, that jnananishta is there, there's no coming back. You're the ajnanam that is responsible for this jivatvam, which is really a product of ignorance, is removed, you know. And so the question always comes up, well, if this ignorance is removed now that I'm involved in the shravana, and the shravana is going to remove ignorance, what happens to me once I understand? If I'm a product of the ajnanam, of the ignorance, and the ignorance is removed, then the jivatvam is gone, then does that mean you die? You know, gain knowledge and die. Swamiji will say, you know, if Yama is hovering over you like that, in terms of your moksha and die, then nobody is going to go toward moksha. You know, nobody goes toward Yama. He's not the most popular guy in the room, you know. And so, but on the other hand, Yama is the person, Yama is the deity whom everybody has to account to, pay account to. And so of all of the disciplinarians or all of the controllers, you know, I am the one that everyone has to face, that everybody has to answer to. So that's that verse. Now he goes, Prahladas chasmidai janam, Prahladas chasmidai janam, Kala-kaliyatamaham, Kala-kaliyatamaham, Mriganam-cha-mrigendroham, Mriganam-cha-mrigendroham, Vaitaneyas-cha-pakshinam, Vaitaneyas-cha-pakshinam, Praladaha-cha-asmi, Daityanam, Kala-kaliyatamaham, Mriganam-cha-mrigendroham, Mrigendroham, Painateyascha Pakshinam. He says, Daityanam, among the Daityas, I am Prahlada. The Daityas are those who are descendants from Diti. Diti is the mother. So there are, in India, you know, you have this descendants. Like, say if you have your mother, the maternal line, we will acknowledge the maternal line of your descent, you know, as well as the paternal line. And so here, daitya comes from ditti. For those who know a little Sanskrit, you know that ditti, that's a short e. When we do the lineage, I am the son or daughter of someone, it's called we can make a derivative word off of that called a tadita, where you will give vriddhi to the simple vowel, so e becomes I. And you'll see this like Kunti. If I were to say Arjuna is the son of Kunti, his mother, it would be Kaunteya, where the U takes vriddhi. So you can recognize these kind of patronymics in this way. So here, if you say...
matronymics.
Yeah, and matronymics, so both. So among the daityas, those who are descendants from the maternal figure, Diti, I am Prahlada. And for Prahlada, again, there's a story that... I mean, I've heard these stories many times. I haven't heard all stories many times. But this is one of them, where the daityas were demons, asuras. And the father of Prahlada was named Hiranyakashipu. So sometimes it's called Hiranya, but it's Hiranyakashipu. And so he wanted in his kingdom for everyone to do japa to his name. So it would be Hiranyanam Namaha. Hiranyanam Namaha. This is what everybody was supposed to do. He was supposed to be the deity who was being worshipped. And his little son Prahlada, who was only 6 or 7, would not do it. He refused to do it. He, even though he was an asura, demon, he was a devotee of Narayana. Narayana is another word for Vishnu. And so he would always be going, you know, Narayanaya Namaha, Narayana. No, no, no. Hiranyaya Namaha. No, Narayanaya Namaha, Narayanaya Namaha. So the father and everybody in the kingdom was realizing that his Hiranya's son was doing this. And so this Hiranyakashipu said, "Bring him to me. You know, bring him to me." And he brought him, and so the Hiranya started talking to this Prahlada and says, "Where is this Narayana of yours? Where is he? Show him to me. Show him to me." And Prahlada said, "He's everywhere. Yeah, he's everywhere." And so then this Hiranyakashipu kicked, he was kind of in the front of his palace, and he kicked the stone pillar. He says he hear and he kicked the pillar really hard. And bursting out of the pillar came the avatar, actually called Netasimhan. Netasimhan means the man lion. Now this Hiranyakashipu had, don't worry, it would take too long, but I just want you to kind of know this little story. He had received a boon some time ago that made it impossible to kill him, at least he thought so. The boon was very complex, and it said something like, "I can't be killed by a man or a woman. I can't be killed during the day or the night. I can't be killed inside or outside." And he went through all of these things and he felt, "I have it covered." You know? And so actually this Narasimha had to come to destroy Hiranyakashipu because nobody could get rid of him and he was causing so many problems. And so he came as a man lion, right? Because now he's not a man, he's not a woman, he's a man lion. Or he couldn't be an animal. You can't be a man, you can't be a human, you can't be an animal, you know. And so he came as a man lion, half man, half lion, with a lion's head. And he came out of the pillar that was right on the threshold between the inside of the outside. It was the doorway. And so he couldn't he couldn't be killed on the ground. And so Narasimha took him, sitting in the threshold, took him on his lap at dusk because he couldn't be killed during the day or at night, and destroyed him. That's the story. And so Prahlada is considered a great bhakta of Vishnu, Narayana. And so he was then appointed to rule the kingdom. So now, so Krishna says, "Among the daityas, I am Prahlada."
I forgot, is Prahlada the son?
The 6-year-old son. Okay. Hiranyakashipu
very Gilbert and Sullivan-ish.
is the demon father.
Who was he worshipping? The father?
The father was worshipping himself.
Oh, just himself.
Yeah. So, Then he says, Kalaha Kaliyatamaham, among those who are, among the accountants, the Kaliyatam are those who count, who keep track, you know, who count. In fact, Shankara here says, how does he say? He says, the ones who are doing gadanam kurvatam, among the ones who are doing counting, I am Kalaha, I am time. Because time never stops ticking. It never stops counting, moment to moment to moment to moment.
Oh, that's
nice.
So
it goes endlessly. So among those who keep track, among those who are counting, mm-hmm. I am time, I am Kalaha. Then he says, Mriganam cha Mrigendraha aham. Among the mrigas, mrigas are the animals that live in the forest animals, the wild animals. So among the wild animals, I am the Mriga Indra. I am the lord of the wild animals, which Mrigendra is a name for the lion. So Swamiji talks about saying that, you know, the bravest animals in the jungle are the lions and the tigers. But there's a difference between them. He says, the lion has no fear, fearless. Both are kind of the king of the jungle in a sense, but the tiger will stay away from the lion. The tiger has fear of the lion, but the lion doesn't have fear. And so the lion is the one, is the king of the jungle. And Swamiji talks about it for quite a while as being the one who is free of fear. All of the other animals will have fear. And Swamiji even talked for a long time. Even the lion doesn't even have fear of the elephants. Even though the elephants are, you know, the elephants are very strong and they attack, you know. The lion has no fear. The lion is just careful. Because the lion, the lions can even kill an elephant. But the lion is careful. He won't attack head on to an elephant. And he'll stay to the side. He has to be very careful. But he's not afraid, you know. Whereas the other animals will have fear. The lion is the exemplar, the archetype for fearlessness. So he says, among all of the jungle animals, the wild animals, I am the lion. And then he says, Vainateyaha Pakshinam. Among the birds, pakshis are those that have wings. So among the birds, I am Vainateya. Vainateya is a name for Garuda. Garuda is actually a figure that comes as Garuda is an eagle. The eagle is the one that has a white around the neck, is the one that soars higher than any of the other birds. So the eagle is considered the most exalted of the birds. But also, Garuda comes up in the Ramayana. Also, is the bird, I think the bird that takes Rama, you know, in searching for, remember quite how that goes, searching for Sita, or Garuda is injured as he's searching, or killed as he's searching.
Yeah, doesn't he get killed?
I think he gets killed as he's searching for. So the Garuda is a mythological, that's the myth, kind of the mythological bird, Garuda. But if you just take it as one of the birds, then it's the eagle. And the eagle that soars higher than any other bird is the Garuda. So among all of the birds, I'm Garuda. But Garuda always brings to mind also, you know, the Garuda, the Ramayana. So, okay, let's go on. Pavanath Pavatam Asmi Rama Shastra Bhatamaham Jashanam Makadas Chasmi Shrotam Asmi Janavi Pavanaha Pavatam Asmi Ramaha Shastra Pratamaham Jashanam Makaraha Cha Asmi Shrotasam Asmi Janavi. He says, Of those things which purify Pavatam, I am Pavanaha. Pavanaha means the wind. The wind is what blows away in the wind, the Vayu, blows away all of the dust, blows away all of the dirt. So in this creation, the greatest of the purifiers is Vayu, the puppet of the wind, because the wind blows away all of the impurities, you know, from the space. So Pavanaha Pavatam Asmi, Ramaha Shastrabhatam Aham. Of all of the those who bear Shastra's weapons, who have weapons, I am Rama. Remember, Rama is the one that had to cross the ocean to find Sita and fight Ravana. Ravana had 10 heads. Ravana is the great deity. He had 10 heads. Like the 10 heads, each head is like a sprouting ego, a sprouting ahankara. And Rama had to conquer Ravana, you know, shooting arrow after arrow after arrow after arrow. And every time he would get one head, it would pop up again. You know, kill one head, pop up again. Till finally he had to get Ravana right in his heart. But there's no greater warrior, in a sense, you know, than Rama. And Rama, through the killing of Ravana, regained Sita. And Sita is Shanti. So Rama is the one who revels, but he lost his Shanti. Rama comes from Ram, to revel, you know. But he lost Sita. Sita was stolen, so he lost his Shanti. And he had to regain, he had to fight the worst of the demons, the Ahankara. You know, the greatest of the demons, the Ahankara. The hardest one to kill in order to get Sita back, to get his Shanti back. And so Rama is considered to be the great, the of all of the ones who bear arms, Rama is the greatest. So, Jashanam Makaraha Cha Asmi. And among the Jashas are large fish. Among the large fish, I am Makara. I am the shark. And Makara usually means shark. It can also mean crocodile. Okay, so Swamiji was talking about this. He said, you know, shark, well, shark, you know, the shark is very strong, very fast, and in fact, it's all teeth. Shark is all teeth, you know, and it's very, very powerful. But then, you know, another big animal is the whale. Yeah. Another one of the big, you know, big fish. He mentioned crocodile, but it could be the whale. Because, you know, the whales are gentle, right? And they're huge, you know. But, okay, so of all of the big fish, then he goes, of all of the big fish, I'm the whale. That could be shark. He goes, but it could be shark. It could be the shark. Because they're so strong also. You know, but if you look it up in the dictionary, it's shark and crocodile. Uh-huh. You know? Yeah. But sweet. But another thing to know is that this word makara, and being used as either shark or crocodile, it comes in a lot of verses where talking about samsara, lost in the ocean of samsara full of sharks and crocodiles. You know? Rescue me from this ocean of samsara, which is teeming with makaras. Mm. Teeming with sharks and crocodiles ready to cause me pain, to hurt me. So of all of these big sea, but the big fish, I am the makara. And then Shrotasam Asmi, of all of the rivers, I am Janavi. You know, I am the Ganga. It's a word for the Ganga. I am the Ganges. And the story about that is the Ganga is considered in India to this day to be the most sacred river. And it's always been believed, and actually I don't know if it's true because there's so much pollution now that it could have contaminated even the Ganga. But the Ganga, this river, it's considered a sacred river, really just a river of knowledge coming out of Shiva's head from the top of the, you know, the Himalayas. But it's an unusual water in that it's always maintained its purity, where nothing would the water itself would never spoil, and also any bacteria or any type of creatures in that water would, you know, bacteria in the water would die. And so people would always, even the ships used to fill, would always go to the Ganges to fill their water, you know, because the water would not spoil. And people will have vessels of Ganga water. I even have one. Somebody brought me back, I think it was Bill, brought me back some Ganga water. And actually Jagadish brought me a thing of Ganga water also. Because in India, they'll always have, you know, a vessel of Ganga water on their altar. And they will keep it for generations, you know, and that water maintains its freshness. And so that's the way, that's very common. Everybody in India knows that, feels everybody has Ganga water in their home in some way. And so there's one story where some pundits, I guess, were asked, you know, it's kind of a simple question, what is the most sacred river? And everybody said, the Ganga, of course. The Ganga is the most sacred river, you know. Except for only one pundit. And that pundit said, Yamuna, the river Yamuna. And everybody looked at him, what? How could you say that? Yamuna. And he said, well, because Lord Krishna bathed in Yamuna. And since Lord Krishna bathed in Yamuna, Yamuna is the most sacred river. And then they said, well, yeah, but what about the Ganga? And he goes, who says the Ganga is a river? He says, the Ganga is Jnanam. And so the Ganga is viewed as the flow of Jnanam coming out of the head of Lord Shiva. He says, who says the Ganga is a river? The Ganga is the flow of Jnanam from Lord Shiva. That's one of the stories. Let's do the next one. Sarganam adirantascha, Sarganam adirantascha, Madhyanchaivaham Arjuna, Adhyatma Vidya Vidyanam, Adhyatma Vidya Vidyanam, Vadav Pravatamaham. Now here, because earlier in the chat, let me do this, Sandeep. Sarganam Adihi Antaha Cha Madhyam Cha Eva Aham Arjuna Adhyatma Vidya Vidyanam Vadaha Pravadatam Aham. He says, of all creations, I am the Adihi and the Antaha. I am the beginning and the end. Adi means beginning, Antaha means end. Of all creations, I am the beginning and the end, Madhyam cha, and the middle. Eva means indeed, aham. Hey Arjuna, aham, I am. For all creations, the beginning, the end, and the middle. And so now here, what they're taking as creations means all beginnings in the world, rather than previously he said on this other level, I am the Srishti, Stiti, and Laya. Means the Srishti means I am the one from whom the creation comes. I'm the beginning, Brahmaji. I am the maintaining of the creation, and I am the resolution of the creation, talking about the whole Maya. But now he says, for every beginning, you know, for every activity, for everything, every creation, there's different ways you can take it. One is, I am, first of all, the very sankalpa that arises in your mind. I'm the very thought that rises in your mind. And then I am the bringing that to life, the creating of it. I'm the sankalpa. I am the doing of it. And I am the end of it also. So you can take this Adi as the sankalpa that rises in the mind and then manifests. Right? Because anything that you do starts with a sankalpa. It says, I am that sankalpa. Right? Then you can take it also just for any activity, any creation that you yourself are engaged in. I am the beginning, middle, and end, just simply. But it's nice to think of it as sankalpa, that the sankalpa is coming from me, not from you. So, I am the beginning, middle, and end of all created things, of all things that are created, or in all things that you create, I'm the very sankalpa. And then he says, adhyatma vidya vidyanam, of all of the vidyas, of all of the knowledges, I am self-knowledge. I am the knowledge of the self. Right? Of all the knowledges that are there, I am the knowledge of the self. In fact, without the knowledge of the self, every other knowledge is based in ajnanam. You know? It's not going to be totally correct, right? Because it's existing within samsara relatively. There's other things that to understand too about relative knowledge. Well, to say that it's not exactly correct is, of course, a simple way of saying it. But in relative samsara, there's no way to really know anything, because everything is infinitely connected and comes and can be known from literally an infinite number of viewpoints. This is a big thing that the Jains come to. You know, everything is infinitely divisible, everything can be viewed from an infinite number of standpoints, and everything is infinitely interconnected. And so for you to know anything, you would have to be a sarvajna. You'd have to be omniscient, because there's no way to boundary or circumscribe your knowledge. By doing that, you're cutting off so many things. And yet, it doesn't mean that we can't know anything. We gain knowledge, but it's very relative, right? And we're continually also viewing in science, we're viewing everything that we think we know. You know, we're discovering another way to view that, you know. But in self-knowledge, that is the one knowledge which, in fact, can be totally known. Absolutely totally known. Because self-knowledge is the only thing that is one without a second. It doesn't have parts. It doesn't have an up, a down, a right, or a left. There are not two ways to know it. There are not two viewpoints to the nature of the self, to the nature of Brahman. It's only one thing. And so you either know it or you don't. If we go into the creation to try to understand Ishvara, no. We can understand Ishvara as the whole, but we don't really know what the whole looks like. We can say as Ishvara is the infinite, if we say Ishvara is Brahman, we're fine. You know, because that's what Ishvara really is. That's what actually is there. But to try to know Ishvara is to try to understand the infinity of connections and the infinite manifestation of duality. First of all, even to conceive of infinite from the standpoint of the finite is not possible. You know? And so, you can hypothetically understand it, but you can't see it. You can't have a vision of it, other than what Krishna gave to Arjuna. You know? And so even within duality, within Maya, there is no way to really gain any type of knowledge other than just relative knowledge, which is useful. It's useful. But upon inquiry, you go into a whole different dimension, which totally negates everything it just opens up what you thought that you knew. It opens up to a different dimension. And that process never stops. But for the self, that is not true. There is no second thing, right? There is no duality. And so once you know, you know. It doesn't have sides, it doesn't have parts. It simply is your being, and it's not away from you. And it is the truth of everything. And so among all of the you could even say, among all of the knowledge, this is the self is the one that is actually known. Among all of the knowledges, the self is the one that is actually known. The self is the one that gives freedom. The self is what that knowledge of the self is what all beings aspire to in their gaining of relative knowledge. So you could go on and on with what that's, mm-hmm. with the importance of it. He, Shankara says, Adhyatma Vidya, goes, Vidyanam Moksha Artitvat, you know, because of being for the sake of moksha, because, you know, Vidyanam Moksha Artitvat Pradhanam Asme. I am of all of the knowledges, I am Pradhanam. I am primary. I am the most important. Why? Because of being for the sake of moksha. Because of being for moksha. So then the next one is Vadaha Pravadatam Aham. Now there are three types of discussion and interaction in terms of discussion. Three main types. Vada is the one that we do when we're two serious people trying to gain knowledge. The pursuit of vada, of that type of discussion, is to gain knowledge, right? That's vada. So that's what we do. This, each chapter is called a samvada. It's a samvada between Arjuna and Krishna, where both people are intent upon gaining knowledge. And that's what the teacher-student dialogue is not about. Anything but that, really, is the gain of knowledge. So it's called a samvada. But then there's two other kinds. One is called jalpa. Jalpa is a discussion between two fanatics. It's not about gaining knowledge. It's about proving that you are right. When you're proving that you are right, you don't not really listening to the other person. Both want the other person to listen to me. Right? That's jalpa. There's another, and so nothing comes of it, you know. You think, you may call it a discussion, it's not really a discussion, both people are just talking to themselves, you know, and believing that the other should be listening. That's it. So that's the jalpa. The vitanda is interesting. The vitanda is, I present my case to whatever it is that I'm believing, that I'm trying to tell you. And instead of, and then in listening to the other person, right, I present my case, but then the other person's case, I won't even pay any attention to. I will only attack the veracity of the other person, right?
So, a lot of that going around these days.
Yes, exactly. It's all vitanda, you know? It's just slurring the other person. Like, this is what it is. I'm sorry, you don't know what you're talking about. So it has nothing to do with listening to the position of the other person. It's just maligning and slurring the reputation of the other person. That's the vitanda. That's what, I mean, it is exactly what's happening now, you know? And I have no interest in hearing from you because you're not a good person. You know, you're a creature, whatever it is. So here what he says, among those who are doing vada, those who are doing the vada well, pravadatam, this is how Swamiji takes it, among those who are actually doing the vada, not the jalpa or the vitanda, right? I am the vada. Means for those who are engaged in this, the very vada, that very type of discussion, that's what I am. So I mean, you take two people, when you're having a discussion, both people are intent on gaining the truth, gaining the knowledge of the truth. And so that vada, that discussion that is going on, you know, is who I am. I am the discussion that is taking place between those two people. It's a nice way of saying it. The other way I think it could be taken is that among these different types of discussion, vitanda, jalpa, and vada, I am the vada. Among all of the discussions, I am the vada, not the vitanda, not the jalpa. But Swamiji didn't take it that way. And, you know, it's not clear to me. I don't think I'm not sure how Shankara took it. I'm not clear what he's saying here. To look at it more carefully. But Swamiji takes it as, you know, the rising of that discussion. And I love that, because actually when vada is taking place, when that type of sincerity is there, Bhagavan gives so much. You know, it's given. So much clarity is given. So much extra. You start out, you know, unfolding something or getting engaged in a serious discussion where both people, you know, are serious and really want to know, then something's given. Yes. So, yeah, it's like, it's like revealed.
Yeah.
So it's like Bhagavan is saying, I am that vada, I am that revelation that takes place among people who are seriously inquiring. That's how Swamiji takes it. Let's stop there. We did well. Mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3, 4. We only did 5. Gosh. I'm going to stop anyway. Just take a minute. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
These are all of these verses pick out the best of whatever is being looked at, and then they say that that's Ishvara. But at the beginning of this series, he said there was a better way of seeing me, you know, than highlighting these best qualities.
Yes, that's true. If you, you know, if you see the Mahavakya, I am the self in all beings, mm-hmm. you know, then that's the most complete, and that's the truth of it. But if you want to worship me, you know, in the creation, then look at all of these things that are, let me highlight these things for you. Not that I'm not everything, because I'm everything in the creation. But then these things are exalted, you know.
But I thought, seeing that he's the material cause for the creation, that in itself is, Krishna was saying it was a better way of seeing me.
Well, he said, instead of saying better way, I think what he actually said is, if you can see me like this, mm-hmm. you know, if you can see me like this, but if this eludes you, then see me like this.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Because pretty soon I forget all these various ways.
I know, but you're not supposed to remember all those various ways. You're supposed to understand the spirit.
Yeah, yeah.
So that you can actually, you know, scan the creation. I actually, for me, that works. I appreciate this, and it's, you know, it is what it is. But you know, when you do Rudram, Mm-hmm. In Rudram, it's just a little bit different in that in Rudram you're going and seeing this is, you know, salutations to the lamp, salutations to the rug, you know, salutations to the dirt, you know, mm-hmm. to the dirt clod, and salutations to the nobleman, and salutations to the villain or to the, you know, robber.
Into the arrows, into the arrows.
Absolutely everything. That's easy for us. That's easier for us because we don't have such a mythology that we could go through and do what Krishna is doing. But it's not as easy as going through and doing namaha to absolutely everything that you can see. And you can kind of imagine a rishi, you know, sitting in wherever he was chanting that, just going through the whole world of his experience. Everything kind of associative thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, this brings this to mind, which brings this to mind, which brings this to mind. And all of it is Ishvara. The Rudram is very wonderful that way. You know?
If you were to be thinking of all those things like that, then very negative things would also be included.
They are in Rudram. That's all included, everything. Positive and negative and neutral. And even little things and big things, like I'm the flowing river, I'm the foam of the wave, I'm the tender grass.
I'm the tsunami.
I'm the, yeah, all of it. And for people also, you know, I am the little, excepting, I forget the word for it now, but it means a person who's insignificant. I'm the insignificant person, and I'm the exalted person, you know.
Can you really hold that way of looking at the world? I mean, that's just so different than the background.
Well, as your knowledge becomes clear, whenever you're in a vairagya moment, and vairagya moment means at that particular time, you're not wanting or needing anything to be different. Mm-hmm. So whenever that is your situation, then you do see everything as Ishvara, because there's nothing blocking that vision. Mm-hmm. When your desires are coming up with any type of force, then that brings on this jivatvam, you know, and then you don't see everything as Ishvara. Unless you've become accustomed to seeing even that jivatvam as Ishvara, you know? So you just, how far back do you go? How much is objectified? If even the negative feelings or the hurts or whatever is going on in your mind are objectified, you're seeing that as Ishvara too, and that's actually very helpful, you know? To where, when you see negative emotions as Ishvara, and you've done some reflection on that, then what you're actually seeing is that this particular emotion is a product. Any and all things are products. Products means, and for something to be produced, there has to be a network of laws that allow for the production of that. And so when you start seeing your emotions and your reactions and your needs also as something that is produced as a product, in a sense, out of the whole, you know, then there's an objectivity there. And then you can say, I accept this as it is.
And where does Dharma come into that? Because if you're accepting everything as it is, then you're not really differentiating between...
No, you have to go like this. If an adharma has taken place, say by you, you know, you'll also reap the results of it. So you recognize it as an adharma, you know, this is what happened. These are the results of that that's happened. That's also, I mean, adharma isn't outside of Ishvara's laws. That's not at all to say, okay, it's Ishvara, let me do adharma. No, because the adharma, we continue... Even without knowledge, you continue to learn not to do a dharma, and that you learn over and over again, because it's like putting your hand in fire. It hurts. It creates problems. It creates the lack of shanti in your mind. You know, and so any... And I think in that way, a dharma itself is a great teacher. You know, because every time you do it, you suffer. You know? You suffer unrest or dis-ease or, you know, isolation. And so it's kind of, if you're feeling those things, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes it's really useful to just objectify it and see everything that came into play to bring that about. You know, and then you can see what took place and you can say, okay, this is a product.
Well, you know, to see all is just raw. What about, maybe it's a current problem I have now, is we have these sorry politicians. I mean, just disgraceful types. And I lose my peace over those guys when I look at them and I hear what they're saying. I just get tight inside. Is that not seen, or should I see that tightness as Ishwara as well, and expect that to be there, or how do I see these people like that? You know.
Well, I think that when you're seeing them, that it's not the happiest of experiences. Mm. You know, but you don't have to get so engaged. You can be objective and try to do something about it. Mm-hmm. But the problem is when you find yourself getting totally twisted by it. That's the raga dvesha, where it really grabs you. It's like, I want this to be in a certain way so that I can be happy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not at all to say that this is your preference to have this type of political situation going on. It's not preference. But then what happens to you? Is it necessary for you to become so distraught, or can you deal with the situation as it is? You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Like what can you positively do to make a difference, or to deal with it without getting so distraught?
But you know, it's almost natural to get distraught, though. I mean, I remember some of the governors we've had here in California that have just been outrageous.
You know? But it's also
that distraughtness there, you know.
But you can also say it's natural to get sucked into samsara, right? Which is,
I mean, that's the fundamental
problem that we are. I mean, that's kind of, when you look at that, whether you get, you know, upset about the politicians, or you get upset about your life partner, or you get upset about your child or your work, or it's endless, kind of, you know, it's kind of, seems like so endless, you know, with bringing that on board, what we're talking about here. So that viveka, you know, what you...
Why, in the end, I think, is it worth it to get so distraught? You know, why can't you do what you can to help?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why give away your shanti?
That's exactly. I mean,
yeah, that's a good question.
But I mean, but if that becomes the experience, then so you've given this away. But then if it's all Ishwara, then you can recognize that. Even though that's been taken from me, or I've given it up, there's another way of looking at that too, then, right?
There is another way of looking at it, but you're going to want to pull your mind back,
mm-hmm.
because you're drowning in your reaction. Yeah.
But could you say that negative response, or that out of control response, that's part of the order, and that's part of...
It's part of the order in that you're able to have an out of control response.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so since it is a possibility.
Yeah. Right?
But then the question is, it's also possible not to have an out of control response.
Yeah.
And so, which do you prefer?
I like to be mellow.
So the dispassion, you know, that's an interesting point, because this dispassion factor.
You know, you should look at dispassion, because dispassion is a word that can be misleading. Mm. It makes you think kind of emotionally flat or uninvolved, and that isn't what's meant. You know, it's meant that you can be objective.
Well, that's what I mean.
And deal with the situation.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You need to have a certain dispassion for the situation with the politicians, right? Isn't that kind of how you could also... I was just kind of wondering, is that... fits that context, the concept of dispassion applied to the situation.
You know what else? You know, in the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, all of these epics and itihasas, they call it, they always have these Kali Yuga type situations. You know?
Yeah.
And so when you read all of these epics, then it covers such huge vistas of time and situations that when something like this is happening, which is pretty outrageous, you say, "Oh, this is Kali Yuga." You know, it's Kali Yuga, because you've seen it. You've seen these things play out in these myths in the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. You see, this is like a repeating cycle. You know, and then how it's handled and what happens and how Ishwar comes in and saves the day and all these kind of things. But what I'm saying is that you have something that is important, like the Ramayana and the Mahabharata are important. All of those stories are something that can hold these stories. You know, and then you see how Rama dealt with it or how Krishna dealt with it. Because like Duryodhana and all of those people were horrendous. And they had no dharma at all. And they go, and the Mahabharata goes into great length showing the total adharma, all of the lies and all of the treachery and all of these type of things, and how a person who is a dharmanishta, how to deal with all of that, you know? So that you have some kind of a role model for how you should be in the situation. Otherwise, you can, if you're politically inclined, as you are, you just find yourself flailing because you don't have, like a role model or something to follow as a teacher, a mentor, teach you how to be in the situation.
Being politically inclined, it's the damage, the direct damage you can see that emanates out of them. You know, I mean, they can go on talking, that's fine, but then they create problems.
They
that,
do.
That you get personally touched by. That's where it's not politically inclined. It's different than that.
Well, no, I don't. All right.
Okay.
But what I'm saying,
right, you guys.
No, let's listen to me.
I have been dismissed.
No, I'm still talking, Edward.
Oh.
Please. You can, by politically inclined, what I meant is there are a lot of different people. You know, some people, and there's a lot of different things going on in the world. Some of the things grab one person. Mm-hmm. You know, another set of things grabs another person. Mm-hmm. One set of positive things grabs one person. Another set of positive things grabs another person. You don't have enough energy to spread it over the whole creation. You have your own set of sensitivities and likes and dislikes. It doesn't mean that, say, your fury is directed toward this set, but another person could say, not see all of that and say it's horrible, but their fury is directed somewhere else. See what I mean? And so that's where the karma is. That's where the sensitivity is. And that's where you need to work on becoming more objective in terms of having nishtha in this knowledge.
Yeah. But just one last thing. These verses, like Rudram will say, see Rudra in the worst of worst.
Yes.
That's...
See, Ishwar in the worst of worse.
And yeah, so that's where we're going with this, in a way.
You could say in a way, but it also just has to do with your being able to kind of contain the situation. Mm-hmm. With whatever you're
looking at. Yeah, that part's there as well. You
know? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But even say if you say, see it as Ishwara, I think it helps also to see it as Ishwara's order. It's mm-hmm. Ishwara's order. All of these things are existing and you know, coming to fruition as part of Ishwara's order. And you could even also say, well, we get what we deserve on a collective level. A lot of this stuff has been building up for a long time. There's been a lot of abuse. A lot of terrible things have happened, and a lot of things are rupturing now. So, you know, it's all within Ishwar's order. Mm. And it's all hitting the fan now. Mm. You know, sooner or later, it is going to hit the fan.
Yeah.
Now that is happening. And if you trace it back, you can see, you know, the steps, you know, that came into play to get us into this kind of a situation. You know, it's complicated, but if you want to look at it like that, this all hasn't happened, you know, out of nothing. So.
Yeah. You know, I have a question just about this interface of jnana, karma, and you know, the three different types of yogas, you know.
Yeah.
Jnana yoga.
Bhakti, karma
bhakti
yoga.
And karma yoga. Mm-hmm. You know, how they interface in the Gita, you know. Is there a certain... It seems like it's such a core theme that it's like, yeah, it's called for action, you know.
Well, what if you did... But they're all different sides of the same coin, in a sense, where... Like even in the Gita, it says like my greatest bhakta is the jnani,
yeah.
Because that one really knows me.
Right.
You know, it's not that three paths lead to the same goal. So there's a bhakti path that leads to liberation and a karma path that leads to liberation. That is not at all accepted.
Yeah,
in
no,
the Gita.
Yeah, that was also quite where I was going with it, but it was kind of more. I'm just kind of trying to understand the dance that these three forces, so to speak,
what about what
enter
you think?
Into in the Gita. Because, you know, there's so much emphasis on you got to act. You know, it's like you got to act, not from that place of I'm the kata, right? But from the place of knowledge. And so here, Arjuna and Krishna in the battlefield, and it's all about jnana. But it's also about, okay, now it's time for action. You know, there's this curtain. I don't know where this actually leads. I've not read the whole thing, but I'm very curious. How's this going to resolve, actually, you know?
Well, there is no choice as long as you have a body.
Yeah.
You have to act.
Yeah.
It's your prarabdha is, you know. In your prarabdha, there's certain things that are enjoined upon you just as a human being in your situation. Those things you have to do, you know? And so that's where the whole karma yoga comes in, and then that also resolves into seeing that whole thing is nothing but Ishwara. But Arjuna had the problem of, let me not do any of this, let me run off to the forest and take sannyasa. And so then you have to understand, well, who is really qualified to take sannyasa and why, you know? And why should you stay in the middle of your environment, you know, and gain knowledge, staying in the middle of your environment? And Krishna says, of the two, the best is to stay in your environment and gain knowledge, mm-hmm. right? Because otherwise there's no way to neutralize all of the habits and all of the things that cause you problems. Once you've neutralized all those things, then, of course, it won't matter whether you're staying there or going into the forest. But to try to neutralize a lot of these desires and things where you're in the middle of the forest, you don't have a field to do that. Mm-hmm. And so then there's that discussion over the difference between staying in the world and renouncing everything and going and taking sannyasa is the thing, you know. But in the end, the karma yoga sannyasa, the complete sannyasa, is only knowledge. You know? And so how to gain the antakarna shuddhi, that purity of mind or the nakshanti, in order to really gain that knowledge, to realize that you are. You only, Atma, is the only, the real sannyasi. There is no other sannyasi. Your body can't but act. Your brain can't but act by its very nature. So the only one who's really free from karma is the self. You know. And so then all the karma that we do has to be in light of our knowledge. Right? So that's the whole karma yoga buddhi comes in. You know, mm-hmm. Kind of understanding the mechanics of that. Bhakti is the more you know, the more bhakti that is there. Mm-hmm. You know.
Just kind of follows its own nature.
Absolutely, and then seeing Ishwara in all beings. And all through the Gita, it's I am the Self in all beings. I am the akarta in the karta, you know. But everything is always Ishwara. Seeing all of this is Ishwara, responding to all of this is Ishwara, you know. And that's jnanam, and that jnanam is bhakti. Because your jnanam is not away from the recognition of Ishwara.
Right. So it's kind of interesting what you were saying, you know, that Rama had to just chop off these 10 heads, or Ravana presenting the superego, you could say, right? And he had to just, and what he was really doing was kind of demolishing his own superego to kind of get Sita back and find the peace, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what
we're talking
about, right?
The whole Ramayana can be taken as like a drishtant or a parable for our own quest of gaining moksha.
It's kind of a secret story.
Yeah,
so
that's
to speak,
right.
That
yeah,
runs
it's always the
behind.
Secret story, right? Right in. Yeah, that's true.
Oh, that's. But how did you know that? For example, how did you know that?
I know from Swamiji.
Oh, you know from Swamiji,
yeah.
You're right. But I mean, because that's a great insight. I mean,
yeah.
I didn't get that when I was reading the Ramayana,
yeah.
You know. So
and Swamiji also, I mean, people have, there's been a lot of writing and things within the tradition about that.
Uh-huh.
Seeing the story within the story. You know, the parable within the story. And also, those are also beautiful because all Rama and Sita, all of them have to handle all of their humanness, all of their emotions, you know, dharma, adharma, how to behave in this situation and that situation.